the project that we began here some months ago is one of discussing or learning together the issues that are most fundamental to the construction of the Jewish mind, authentic Torah concepts that are the fundamental ones. And therefore, let's look at the question, perhaps the deepest, or from a number of perspectives, perhaps the most difficult subject, which is the problem, the classic problem of the contradiction between divine foreknowledge and free will. Many aspects here, much more than we can hope to go into this evening, but let's, as clearly as we can, try to map out this area, try and show its relevance, try and show perhaps one or two approaches to this issue, and define for ourselves at least the axioms from a Torah point of view. It's a very badly misunderstood area. It's an area that's not understood, and when it is, it's misunderstood, usually. But there are popular works out there which are wreak havoc with this fundamental or these fundamentals. Will require unique concentration on all of our parts, because this touches literally on the deepest area of human thinking. This, in fact, I'd like to try to show you that this subject defines the borderline between what we can understand and what we can't. In fact, what we are even forbidden to think about because of its, for one reason at least, because of its impossibility. But with that very difficult task, we set ourselves that very difficult task. Let's see what we can manage. I mean, we're here to learn fundamental Jewish wisdom and fundamental Torah ideas. And this is certainly fundamental. First of all, what is the problem? What is the problem? This is a problem that should have occurred to anybody who thinks about these things. And it's certainly a well known and articulated problem in the sources that deal with it. Perhaps the classic source that raises it is the Rambam in the Laws of Tshuva, which some of us have been learning here Sunday mornings. He there, Maimonides, the Rambam, raises this contradiction or this paradox, and he has an approach to the issue. First of all, what is the issue? There are two principles that are as close as you can get to absolute principles, and they are in conflict with each other. That's the problem. The two principles are the teaching of Hashem's absoluteness, which implies, of course, his foreknowledge. That means he knows things. In our borrowed terminology, since we live within the world of time, we would say before they happen. But whether that terminology is even relevant to him is debatable. Try and see that a bit more in depth. But he knows things before they happen. Let's put it in simple human terms. Before you choose whatever it is you'll choose, before you take the course of action you'll take tomorrow, he knows that you will take that course of action. I mean, that's about as solid a statement as you can ever hope to make in Torah thinking. The deepest axiom of all is his all-encompassing perfection, and it certainly includes his knowledge. The second axiom is that you have free choice. You have free will. There's very little that's more important than that axiom. Free will is really the basic pillar of all Torah thinking and Torah activity. And think for a moment what it would mean if we claimed that human beings deny a free will. First of all of life would become a meaningless, one-dimensional charade. Everything that you do would be a forced move. There'd be no question of being able to choose or to aspire. There'd be no question of failure. There'd be no question of responsibility. There'd be no concept of reward or punishment. You certainly couldn't punish someone for doing something that they had no option to do any different. And it would be foolish to reward, even conceive of rewarding someone for doing something that they couldn't have done different either. Now, everybody knows, no matter how low your level of Torah education is, you know that the Torah is based on the concept of commandments, obligation, and there's a measure of how you live up to those obligations. That's the concept of consequence. Call it reward, punishment, this world, the next. That's a very, very basic concept, basic to the notion of religion, certainly to Torah. So far, so good. Free will needs to be discussed, exactly what its limitations are. We don't claim that everything's subject to free will. Many months ago we began to look at the subject of free will and some of its own intrinsic and internal paradoxes. But be that as it may, somewhere or other free will applies. There is such a fundamental, there's no question about it, apart from the fact that you know you have free will. In fact, the deepest level of point of reference for your experience of free will is really your experience. It is what we call das. It's your own intrinsic primary inner knowledge. You know that you face a free will ordeal and that it's up to you to choose this or choose that. When you're locked in battle between your higher self and your lower self, your higher self, that side that's more refined, more elevated, is battling the more sensuous, the more animalistic, the more earthy, the more lazy. In that battle, you know deeply within yourself that it's up to you to choose this path or that path. Can you prove that? Can't prove that there's free will. Can't prove in a rigorously scientific sense that there's free will, because the scientist who's a skeptic will always say to you that whatever you chose and thought you meaningfully chose and grappled with and agonized with was really predetermined in your genes and your biochemistry and your cultural, social. You can never prove it. But you know in that deep heart of what it means to be human that moves within you that when you choose one option in an ordeal that you chose, that you could have chosen differently and you didn't, you chose that. And you accept the responsibility. You certainly know you should. Now, without going more into the issue and the concept of free will, but right away you can see that these two principles, at least I hope you can see, that these two principles are in conflict. I hope. Okay, somebody, anyway. If he knows beforehand what I will do, then what meaning does it have? What meaning is that the concept that I choose? If I have to choose this path or that, and by definition he knows beforehand which one I will choose. So when I end up choosing that path, right, what is the meaning, what is the relevance of the concept of free will? It was already known. Do we agree there's a problem here? See the conflict? Not convinced. Not convinced. You have to enjoy the question. There's a problem. There's a direct collision between these two axioms. If it's known beforehand, then that was the only option. If it's known beforehand, it's already mapped out in a higher consciousness that transcends me and my understanding, which of the options will be followed, then that's forced, that really there really was no other option. The fact that I agonize over the choice and feel like I'm choosing, that's an illusion, really. Right? Relative to a higher knowledge, there really was no other option. Now, that is the classic and fundamental conflict in spiritual thinking, and it has been handled and mishandled throughout the ages in various ways. One of the most embarrassing, thoroughly humiliating approaches to this in recent times has been a book that I'm ashamed to say, I'm not even going to mention the source, but, and you certainly shouldn't look it up yourself, waste of time, but it became an absolute bestseller in the English-speaking world, and the solution to this, the phrasing of the question there is why bad things happen to good people. That was the notion, the particular aspect of, and in that particular problem, the author resolves the issue by saying that divine knowledge is not absolute. He actually goes so far as to say that divine power is not absolute. That bad things happen because the Creator is not powerful enough to stop them. Well, you can get out of the question that way. You can say that he doesn't really know beforehand what's going to be, but then that's not our God. That's not Hashem. To say he has deficiency in his knowledge, or to get into philosophical tangles by saying he makes himself deficient. Not like he pretends to himself that he doesn't know. I mean, there are more serious attempts that do take various components of these arguments, but that's not. Let's look at the more authentic approaches to this issue. We don't want to limit Hashem's power or his knowledge, right? We don't want to do that. That is denial of a fundamental in Jewish thinking. On the other hand, we certainly don't want to deny our free will. Because if I don't have free will, everything collapses. So what are the resolutions of this problem? Or what are the approaches to this problem? I'd like to try and show you that there is no resolution. So that's where our faith begins. There's one approach that you'll find in the classical commentators. I'm not going to now quote you references. You can look it up in the Rambam and the commentaries there in detail. But there's one approach that says, in fact, those who claim this approach only claim that it's a partial approach. But for what it's worth, that foreknowledge is not causative. Now let's try and explain this. Foreknowledge is not causative. If I know beforehand what you will do, that has nothing to do with your choice whether you'll do that thing or not. If I'm clever enough to know beforehand what you will do, it in no way means that I ordained in the sense of a destiny, a causative energy resulting in what you did. Yes? If you watch a child, yes, and you see the child start moving across the room to where there are glowing coals, and you know this child, you know that the child's attracted by those glowing objects, and you can see the whole process. You can see that the child will go over, the child will touch, you can see all that. If it turns out that your assessment of what will be, if that turns out to be correct, it's accurate to say that you had foreknowledge, and it's also accurate to say that you do not interfere with the process or cause it in any way to be. Is the point clear? You could know a thing beforehand because you're clever enough to know it, and yet not interfere with the process or cause it in any way. I used to live in a certain place where, certain apartment where the message was brought home to me very clearly. I lived on the third floor of a building where I could see an accident in the street that would occur below me quite a few seconds before it happened. And I could see that it was inevitable. Right? The reason was that there was a side street coming out into a main street, and the way the vehicles were parked was such that it was quite apparent from above that there was no way that a vehicle moving at a given speed down the one street could possibly stop by the time that a vehicle attempting to cross had exposed itself enough to be for the driver to see what... It was just an inevitable situation. And of course, there were routinely, you know, accidents over there, and I could see them well in advance. I could see a number of seconds beforehand that given that this driver was trying to get to a certain point where he could see, and given that that one was coming at a certain speed and that the closing... I could see clearly that it was going to happen. Now, nobody in their right mind would accuse me of having caused them. I mean, I presume. The fact that I could predict it, because I had a superior vision, right, of the situation, it turned out to be accurate foreknowledge, but in no way causative. So there are approaches that say that Hashem's foreknowledge doesn't have to be causative. The fact that he knows beforehand is because he's big enough to know. But it doesn't affect your choice. Is that a satisfying answer?
Yeah.
No. The Rambam discounts that answer. The Rambam does not take that approach. And his reason is that, and it's quite apparent from his answer, that divine foreknowledge is not the same as a human prediction. His foreknowledge is so powerful, the way the Rambam puts it in his dealing with this issue, is that divine knowledge, Hashem's knowledge, is synonymous with what He Himself is. There's no distinction between Him and His knowledge. And what He is everything. Meaning that His knowledge is all that there is. It's not an external judgment witnessing a situation from the outside, like mine. He is all those things. His knowledge is so pervasive and so powerful that there's no room to move outside of that. His knowledge is not only causative, it is all things. Now, causative is too small a word. That means His knowledge leaves no room for anything outside. Like, can you feel this? And therefore, it's only a partial answer to say, well, knowledge and free will do not interact or intersect. His knowledge is so powerful that it can appropriately be called a destiny. His knowledge is so big that there's nothing besides that. And therefore, it's a contradiction to free will. And therefore, the Rambam says, in his own words, that this is an issue we cannot understand. The way he puts it is that Hashem's knowledge, Hashem and his knowledge are one, and he is beyond our understanding. And the meaning of his foreknowledge is something we can't relate to. The way he puts it is that Hashem is beyond time. So it's meaningless to say that he knows something before it will happen. There's no before or after, it's all present. And we can't begin to deal with something that is all present. We can only deal with sequence of events. Rav Dessler used to give an analogy to his students of this, what it means that he transcends sequential events. Rav Dessler used to say, if you imagine a card with a hole punched in the card, and that card is placed over a map, and the hole exposes one site, one location on the map, then you move the card and it exposes another location, and then you move it and it exposes another one. So what you're witnessing is a sequence. But if you could then imagine the card being removed so that you see all places all at once. He said that's a vague analogy for us, that we witness only one event at a time because our consciousness can only take that. But when you view it from the higher perspective, there is no sequence. It is all there at once. There is no one thing being revealed and then the next and then the next. So when you get into that area, that department, that's beyond human understanding, and therefore we can deal with free will. We can say that I can go this way or that way. But to assess what his knowledge means relative to that is off limits. And pretty basically, from a Jewish axiomatic point of view, that is our statement of faith. That we believe deeply that free will is absolutely applied where it's applied, and you're accountable, you're responsible, and you could have gone this way, you could have gone that way, and yet he knew beforehand. Are those two contradictory? Yes. Do they apply anyway? Yes. Can you understand that? No. That is... Yeah. If you need a little bit more, if you need to sit a bit better emotionally, you have to remind yourself that there's certainly something about him that we can't understand. Only a fool thinks that he can understand everything. And we certainly can't understand him. At least some level of what we're given is beyond what we're given. There are levels beyond what we're given to understand, and this is where it is. This is in fact where it is. Let's try and trace this a little bit more deeply. You don't have to be afraid of a contradiction. We're dealing with a spiritual world that's beyond human understanding. This, if you're asked to phrase the point beyond which human minds cannot transcend, this is it. In other religions and other systems of spiritual thinking, they define different points of what can and what can't be understood. Unique to Judaism, probably, is that the point that cannot be understood is this deep. It's at the point of origin of outflow of all that is created, in the very highest levels. Let's try to take this a little bit further. Hesitate to speak about these things, but let's start a little bit lower down first and then see how things feel. The outcome of this idea is that two things are happening in the world at the same time and they're superimposed, although they're impossible. That's our understanding of the world. For example, let's bring it down into human experience. Now, we spoke very high, let's bring it down into human experience. We understand that the world is running according to a pre-known pattern. It's known beforehand, and that's very powerful. And yet, you are making it happen. Well, you have free will. And somehow the two are not in conflict. Let me give you what I hope represents a slightly more tangible example. The Gemara puts it like this. Remarkable, remarkable thing. The Gemara says that King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, once had the following experience. It's a remarkable thing. This single incident, understanding this, will change your life forever. You'll never see the world. After you heard this, you'll never see the world again. The same. Not possible. It's comforting from one side and absolutely terrifying from another. And it's no accident that this message is taught in the context of King Solomon, the wisest of men. He who had the deepest perception, virtually of all human beings who ever lived, he had the deepest. The word Shlomo in Hebrew, I think we mentioned this before, spells Hamashal. Right? The analogy. He was the human analogy for the ultimate wisdom. Hamashal. That means the analogy. Actually, if you rearrange the letters again, it spells Lem Moshe. That means his wisdom approached that of Moshe Rabbeinu. His name means perfection. He once had the following experience. The Gemara says this in the fifth parak of fifth chapter of Gemara Sukkah. The Gemara says this. He once saw the angel of death. He once saw King Solomon, he had a transcendent vision, and he saw the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, Deka'atzif, which means who was sad. He was sad. He saw the angel of death with a long face. He was miserable. So Shlomo, being the man of essential wisdom, he went up to the Malach. You have to understand very deep things being said here. He went up to the Malach HaMavis and he said to him, "Why are you sad?" So the angel said to him, in paraphrasing his words, he said, "Because I've been sent down to take two souls," right? His function in the world, the Malach HaMavis, his function is to take human souls from the world and their lives. "And I've been sent to take two souls and I cannot take them. I cannot take them. I'm not able." And he mentioned the names of these two souls. Gemara says, Trey Kushin, they were two extremely beautiful people. They were close to Shlomo. He knew who they were. They were close associates of his. And when he heard this, he immediately took action. He had them sent by certain secret techniques. He had them sent instantaneously to the town of Luz. Now Luz, again, all of this requires a lot of explanation. The town of Luz is unique in that it is impervious to the Malach HaMavis. He cannot enter. Right? It's a town in which the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, cannot enter that town. If you're in there, you're safe from him. So because he heard that they were targets and the Malach HaMavis were trying to take them, he sent them into the he sent them away to the town of Luz. Luz means that is the same name that is given to the bone here at the base of the neck, the Gemara says, same name, because this is the bone that Talmud says that also deeper sources talk about. This is that when the body decomposes, this remains, some aspect of this remains, and the Tchias HaMeisim, the resurrection we discussed last week, the resurrection is taking place from this, right? It's one of the reasons that we are so extremely concerned about cremation, right? That's why we, there's other reasons for that prohibition as well, and we don't do that, and it's a whole discussion in its own right. But the Tchias HaMeisim is initiated from this center. Actually, there's another source in the Talmud that says that the sustenance of this bone, the food that sustains this bone, is the food that you eat on Motzei Shabbos. Saturday night, when Shabbos goes out, you have a third meal, you have a fourth meal, you have a Melava Malka. Melava Malka, you have the Melava Malka, that accompanying of the Shabbos queen that goes out, like we welcome the Shabbos in, Shabbos goes out. Very important meal. It's a very important meal. Some people light candles also. Melava Malka, the food that you eat then is a very important meal. And it is, the food is nourishing this particular, what's the connection? I mean, again, this needs a lot of, just a hint of, here's not our subject directly, but not to let these things go completely unexplained. The concept is that Luz is the place that's beyond death, right? It's the city beyond death, as it were. You understand, these are very deep things here. These are not, it's not children's tales. There's a zone that's beyond death. And that's what this is. It's the source of the resurrection. It's that which penetrates, as it were, the death process and retains life and is the, what is Motzei Shabbos, what is Saturday night? That's the rebirth of the week. What happens, you see, what happens on Shabbos is that the week has come to an end and its fulfillment and completion. And then there's a recreation of a new week that is taking its energy from the previous, just like the resurrection is a new birth, as it were, taking its energy from a previous completed life. Right? Anyway, the town of Luz is impervious to this Malach. So Shlomo sent his two friends instantaneously before the Malach HaMavis could get hold of them. He sent them instantaneously to the town of Luz in order to save their lives. Says the Gemara, because they, as they arrived at the gates, of Luz, they both died. Before they could enter, they arrived at the gates, they both died. The next day, Gemara says, Shlomo saw the Malach HaMavis, dekabadich, which means he was happy. He was in a jovial mood. So Shlomo went up to him and he said to him, what are you happy about? Not ever the man of wisdom and quest for spiritual understanding. He said, what are you happy about? Said the Malach HaMavis said to him like this, and I'm paraphrasing the words, but he said to him the following thing. You know those two people I was sent to take yesterday that I told you about? You know what my problem was, why I was so upset? Is because my instructions were to take them at the gates of Luz and I couldn't get them there. You see, you think about this event, you see what happened here is that the wisest, the most perceptive of all humans, right, played into the hands of a destiny using his free choice. That means, and you have done it, it's an extreme example. His free choice was used for nothing less than saving human life. Pikuach nefesh, it takes precedence over virtually everything else in the Torah. No details that the Talmud gives us are extraneous and or accidental. The Talmud chooses an example of the wisest and cleverest of human beings engaged in the use of his free will in the highest possible application, right? Saving lives. And in his incredible wisdom, using his free will in the most urgent and spiritual life-saving fashion, brought about the event that he was trying to avoid. What's going on? There was a time for these two people to die, and that was their time. Shlomo was given an opportunity to use his free will, and he used his free will. No doubt he gets reward for saving lives, no question. Because he's a reward for saving lives. That's what he tried to do. But in fact, using his free will to do what he had to do, he played into the hands of what had to be. And the two are going parallel exactly. You're making your free will decisions, you're responsible, and it's working out exactly the way it has to work out. If you think about it a little further, it's even more frightening, because really what happened was, this Malach HaMaves, when he appeared to Shlomo, what was he really doing? He appeared to him and said to him, you know, I'm very sad because I've been sent to take to me, I can't get them. There was just nothing more than a ploy. Of course he could get them there. He knew exactly how to get them there. Appear in front of Shlomo and tell him, you can't take them. He knew exactly what he was doing. He had no problems. He had a whole thing mapped out exactly. And Shlomo fitted in using his incredible wisdom and free choice. He fitted into nothing other than bringing about a destiny that he himself was trying to avoid. He was a tool in the hands of a destiny, and he's using his free will. The way the Gemara sums this up, a remarkable statement. The Gemara says there, the Gemara's comment, an introduction to this, the name that the Gemara calls this, the term by which it's known in the Talmud, is Ragloy Debar Inish Inun Arvin Bay. The legs of a human, they are your guarantors. Your legs are your an Arev is a guarantor for a loan. If you take a loan, someone signs surety for you, they are your surety, your guarantor. Ragloy Debar Inish, the legs of a person, Inun Arvin Bay, they are your guarantors which guarantee your actions in and of yourself. What does it mean? The legs in Torah always mean those elements of the being that are furthest from consciousness. They've got nothing to do with your, right? A regel, the legs in Hebrew are always, in Hebrew the word regel and hergel, which means habit. Amazing, they're the same words. In English, a leg is a leg, a habit's a habit. Two things. In Hebrew, a habit is a leg. Why? Hergel means that which goes by the legs alone. There's no thinking. A habit is something you do because you don't think about it. There's no head involved. It's just a rote pattern that the legs are outside of consciousness. They're in Kabbalistic writings, they're called Labar Migufa. They're outside the body. The legs are not part of the body. The body ends by the bris. That's where the body ends. The legs are Labar Migufa. They're outside the body. They are external to the body. That's why a child in the Talmud, it's a much deeper subject, but a child in the Talmud is called a leg, a foot of the father. And a fetus is called a thigh of the mother. Children are somehow the legs of the parents. And what does that mean? It means they're outside of the parent, but just like the legs carry the body through space, through the world, children carry the parents through time. But the parents' being rides through the world, and through history as it were, on the children. Just like the body rides through the world on its legs. So children are... But the legs that bear you, right, which are outside of consciousness, they are nothing more than your habit. They are your guarantors. That means you think with your head you're going where you have to go, and it turns out your legs took you there. That's the way it works out. What's happening? The world is comprised of two currents of energy working at the same time. You do what you have to do and you take responsibility, but it's working out exactly the way it has to work out. There are a lot of questions with this, a lot of difficulties that are raised. How did it happen this way in the first place? Was Adam's sin? You know, there are a lot of issues, but that's a clue to the direction. To take it a little deeper, these are things one has to be cautious about discussing, perhaps beyond. But you know, this paradox goes to the root of creation. In the very root of creation, in the beginning of the whole process, the phrasing of this paradox, and I hope you can see this with me, is really the tension between the question, the two sides of the question of whether the world is real or not. Let's try and phrase this more clearly. I don't know if you have any interest in history, but our deeper sources say this was the point at issue between the early Hasidim and the early Misnagdim. That in the history of the Hasidic idea, that this issue in its deepest level was at issue. And that was the question of whether the world is real or not. You see, we have a principle, and I'm sure you'll hear the contradiction very, very clearly. We have a principle that's and we discussed this before, that's called Ein Od Milvado, there's nothing besides Hashem. Ein Od Milvado, there's nothing besides Him. The way the Zohar puts it, is Leis Asa Panamine. There's no place free, there's no place that's not pervaded by the essence of Hashem's being. That's all there is, there's only Him. Then the question is, who are we? Well, who are we? What's the world? What is the essence? What's the nature of a finite world? How can there be? How can there be a world, let alone with evil? Let alone. But a world of finite deficiency, that means where this, where a thing ends, it has a finite measure. Yes? So how do things freeze, crystallize into finite form in a world that is all the infinite oneness of Hashem? What do you mean there's nothing besides Him? Well, what am I? So, this question fell into two, the approach to this fell into two camps. The one camp said, we're an illusion. We are illusions. The world's an illusion, not real. In a deep sense, it's not real. Why? Because we don't want to threaten the axiom of Hashem's all-encompassing oneness. Therefore, He's real. We must be. So the opposing camp, they said to them, well, according to you, you claim that, this is a very deep thing here, you claim that the world's all illusory. So according to you, how come you may not say the Shema, for example, in the bathroom? You know, you can't pray, daven, right? Or say things of holiness, or learn Torah, say Shema, for example, in a place of uncleanness. And according to you, there is no such thing as uncleanness. It's all the all-pervading oneness of Hashem's existence. You hear the question? So according to you, what difference is it, this place, that place? So they said, well, we can't really understand that, but that's what it says in the Shulchan Aruch, that's what it says in the Torah, and therefore you can't. Well, we can't understand. But then they turned around to their opponents and they said, according to you, who claim that we are real, and there are differences, places have a reality, what happened to Hashem's oneness? So they said, well, we can't understand that, but that says in Torah that Hashem is only one. And one of the great leaders of the previous generations, I heard once, that he said he once spent 36 hours in a row trying to ponder what difference it made, which side of this problem you take on, and he couldn't figure it out, didn't think about it anymore after that. So, you know, if he wasn't able to resolve which view of the problem is the correct one, because either one you take, you're sacrificing an axiom, a fundamental. Can you feel that? To you and me, it certainly makes no difference. To you and me, is no... But they are fundamentally in conflict. This is the point of origin of our conflict. Can you feel that? Yes, can you see that? On the side of saying that there's nothing besides Him, you are emphasizing the side of the absoluteness of His foreknowledge. On the side of saying that the world is real, not an illusion, you're emphasizing our independence and our free choice, and those two are in conflict. Can you see the root of this? Of course, there were big issues at stake. Big issues at stake. Very big issues. Because if you start teaching, can you see the two conflicts? If you start teaching that we are real, you may, chas v'shalom, break down the fundamental of Hashem's oneness. You might start to see that in a limited sense. That's very dangerous. You take the spirituality and the transcendent she'ifa, desire to... On the other hand, if you say we're all illusory, then the world of halakha becomes very... Not so important anymore, because, you know, we transcend it anyway. You can do things at strange times because we transcend time. You can do all sorts of things because the world's not real. They're very dangerous outcomes. And probably both of those two streams of consciousness within Judaism, they modified each other. And the result was the beautiful outcome, which was the fully thriving two streams of consciousness, which each give sanctity and complementary energy to each to the other. So what have we learned so far? There's a fundamental conflict between Hashem's foreknowledge, which is absolute, free will, which is an absolute axiom in Torah. It's rooted in the deepest level of the creation itself, which itself is a conflict between the oneness and all-encompassing essence and existence of Hashem, and yet our independent existence here, freedom to do things. The output in the world, we said, is that life follows a pattern where you have responsibility, but it's all going where it has to go. There's a Mishnah which says as follows. Can we take this a bit further? The Mishnah says this. Remarkable thing. The Mishnah says, first of all, it's brought without a name. There's a number of Mishnahs in Pirkei, obviously, look it up yourself. You see that the preceding The preceding Mishnah is mentioned in the name of Rabbi Akiva. But this one starts unusually with no name. Normally in Pirkei Avos, about the ethics of the fathers, as it's called, a Mishnah begins quoting the name of the sage who said the statement, or at least it says, Hu Haya Omer, he would say, meaning a continuation of the previous statement. This one has absolutely no introduction. It just starts kol, out there, and it says the following statement. I called Safui, everything is seen. Safui means, Sofer in Hebrew means an outlook, like a scout who has a distant vision, right? I called Safui, everything is, what it means here is everything is foreseen. I called Safui, Varashus Nesuna, Rashut Netuna, and free will is given. And thirdly, Ubatuv Ha'olam Nidon. Right? Ubatuv Ha'olam Nidon. And with goodness the world is judged. Now, there are a few problems with this statement. The first is, what's the connection between these three things? The world is judged with goodness. What does that mean? What does it have to do? The second question is, think about it for a moment. Hakol Tzofu means everything is foreknown. Means Hashem knows beforehand what's going to be. The question that raises is, you don't need a Mishnah to tell you that. You don't need a Mishnah to tell you that, right? It's far more axiomatic in Jewish thinking that Hashem is and knows everything than a Mishnah comes and has to announce it. Right? Second statement, that you have free will, is even more unnecessary. For a Mishnah to announce that you have free will is completely and utterly unnecessary. As soon as you create a Torah and you give it to a human being and you tell him you are bound, you're obliged, you'll be rewarded, you'll be punished, you're telling him he has free will. Yes, do you see this? No Mishnah has to come and announce, right, in Pirkei Avos, that after you've learned everything else, you have free will. And the answer to these two difficulties is one and the same. There's nothing new, and no news, what we call no chidush. There's no chidush, there's nothing new in telling me that Hashem knows everything. And there's nothing new in telling me that you have free will, but what is massively new is that the two apply at the same time. What the Mishnah is doing is putting these two things together to teach you. Can you see this? The Mishnah is saying to you, Hashem knows beforehand what you're going to do, but don't think it tonight. Don't say you don't have responsibility. You couldn't have chosen different. You couldn't have chosen otherwise. You have free will. Those two juxtaposed, that is an intense chidush. That is an immense novelty, right? That a person has to, that's beyond understanding. You have to assimilate and absorb. Now the third statement, and the world is judged in goodness. What does this mean? Ubatuv ha'olam nidon. These are very, this require a lot of thought. What does it mean the world is judged with goodness? Can you hear the contradiction? I hope you can. The word din in Hebrew, can we go into something a little deeper here? Not sure. Let's see if we can trace our steps into a deep realm. You have a concept called din. Din. Din means justice, strict, absolutely strict justice. Din. Goodness is the opposite. When it says that the world is judged with goodness, it means that Hashem is kind. He gives an extension. He gives credit. You do something wrong, you get time to correct it. Can you see that that's in utter conflict with the concept of din? Din means that there's no extensions, there's no second chances. Din means exactly what the law says. Do you know how strict din is? If the world were created only with din, no human being would be able to survive. Because din means if you put one foot wrong, the slightest deviation, you disappear immediately. Just to get a little feeling for the reason for that, is that when any creature disobeys a command of the king, that is synonymous with ceasing to exist. If you want to put it into much lower terminology, just understand the concept of justice. It's really much higher, because when Hashem says something and that's a reality, when you behave out of line with that, you move out of existence. He and his command is one reality. When you move against that commandment, in fact it says that our punishment, you know what punishment will be in the next world for things that you did against his wishes? You'll experience non-existence. For every half hour that you spent doing what he said don't do, the punishment you will experience a half an hour of being there, you'll have the experience of not being. Why? Because is that measure for measure? Yes, because for that half hour you stepped out of existence. What he commands and what he wants is reality. So when you go against his wishes, you're not just disobeying, you cease to exist. The Sfas Emes says a very intensely beautiful description. The Sfas Emes says that Hashem's command devolves, Hashem's desire devolves in the spiritual world until it becomes a commandment, and then it stops and leaves a gap between it and the world. Listen to this most beautiful description. Hashem has a desire. He wants something done. So he formulates it as a commandment, and he stops. And then he invites you to step in and carry it out. If you step in and carry out his desire, listen to the command and carry it out, what ends up being done in the world? What he wanted. So it becomes one, you and he become one structure. His desire, and you are the cutting edge of the action that brings it about. How does this happen? How does this happen? Because when you step in to form the lower half of that circuit, how do you do that? The first thing you have to do is want what he wants. First you have to, with your own free will, you have to want to do what he wants you to do. So you have to mirror in your mind what he wants. And then you have to step in and do it. And that's called Tzelem Elokim. That's called being in Hashem's image. Being in Hashem's image means you use your free will to want what he wants. Make your desire his desire. So what happens? Listen to this amazing idea. Hashem has a desire, as it were. These are very high things to talk about, but we're given these words. Hashem has a desire, the Ratzon Hashem. He forms it as a commandment. You step in, make yourself. You generate the same desire as he does, so you now mirror what he is, and you do it. So you have here you reflecting what he is, and you reflecting the whole structure. Huh? But not only that, the structure makes you essential. Because without you, it would not have been done. You become an essential part of the circuit that gives expression to his desire in the world. And therefore, you and he become one. How do you and he become one? Because unlike if he would have wanted it and you would have had no free will, then you would have just been an instrument. You wouldn't have been anything like him. He would have been the desire, you would have been the tool. He's the puppeteer and you having the strings pulled. But you know, that's not the way it works. You do not have to step in and do what he wants. You can refuse. So when you step in and want what he wants, you mirror what he is. No one makes him want what he wants. He does it purely independently because he wants it. And he says to you, I want you to be the same. So you have to want what he wants independently, voluntarily put yourself in there, thereby melting into an image of what he is, and then what he wants gets done. And that's how you and he become a partnership, melting into a oneness which reflects and manifests in the world after Hashem, but there's nothing besides him. The work is, you have to overcome your ego that says, don't tell me what to do. I don't want to want that. I want to want what I want. I want to stand here. Says this Hashem. When you say that, which is the ultimate test, that was Adam's ordeal. That was his ordeal. Hashem said, don't do what you want. Do what I want. And the phrasing of the commandment was, do nothing. Admit that I'm everything. Do nothing. Don't eat. The commandment was not do something. The commandment was do nothing. Kill your ego. Don't prove anything. Just assert your conviction, your statement, yes, that I'm everything and you're nothing. It requires the destruction of the ego. You have to annul all your desires to be the source and cause and force yourself to want only what he wants. There's a tremendous sacrifice, a sacrifice, a destruction of ego. What does the immature vested interest tell you? Don't tell me what to do. I want to do what I want to do. Says the Sfas Emes. When that happens, you step aside and you feel amazing. You feel amazing. Because you're standing in a place where nobody's telling you what to do. There's no commandment. You, in a sense, are reflecting the divine image in a completely invalid fashion. But it's your spiritual greatness that is leading you to do this. Because you now feel divine. You feel that you are the ultimate cause now. There's nothing that you're making yourself subservient to. It's a tremendous sensation of existence. But what happens at that moment is you cease to exist. Because you just stepped outside reality. The only reality in the world is Einar Bilvan. It's only him. So when you step aside with that childish assertion of who you are, but you just stepped into non-existence. You stepped into a place where there is no circuit. There's nothing. There's no reality there. And not only that, but you left reality uncompleted. And the punishment for that is the next world. What you will sense is, you'll live for the half hour that you spent doing what he does not want you to do. In that half hour that you felt the incredible thrill of being the total self-created individual for whom the whole world exists. In the next world, the sensation will be a sensation of half an hour of complete lack of existence. Because all you did was step out of existence. But not only will you have to, I'm sorry to have to say, but not only will you have to pay for that, you'll not have to pay for this thing, you'll have to pay for what should have been done then, because it wasn't done and you were supposed to be doing it. You left it uncompleted. There's a piece of reality that was you and you didn't do it. Now, can you see why doing what he commands is synonymous with existence? When you step out of doing what he wants, it's not just that you're doing something negative. You cease to exist. We don't feel that now because we live in a world of, let's say, illusion now, what we call Alma de Shikra, the world of lies. That's why you have free will. That's why you have free will now. Every commandment has two levels. And every sin has two levels. For example, let's talk about breaking the Ratzon Hashem. A sin, what we call a sin in Avera. There are two culpabilities in every sin. One is the intrinsic damage. When you do something wrong, like eat food that's not kosher, for example. So there's an intrinsic damage. It desensitizes you. It makes you impervious, more difficult to understand spirituality. For Jewish neshama, right? You are what you eat, and it's a special thing. But there's another problem. That there's a disobedience to what he commands. There's culpability on both levels. And spiritually, the deeper culpability is the disobedience of the command. The damage you do to yourself and do to the world by acting in discord with what he wants is one thing. But the disobedience to the king, for example, can you see, it's a very important thing to understand, can you see that disobedience to the king has a massive difference from the intrinsic harm of what you do? Why? The harm of what you do is proportioned to what you do. The disobedience to the king makes no difference what you did. You disobeyed the king. It doesn't matter how tiny the disobedience is. Can you feel this? No. If you step into the palace, first of all, you have to picture a real king. You have to picture, we don't know what kings are today, kings and queens. Because kings and queens in today's world are empty figureheads. Right, who are rubber stamps of a democratic system. They're a parody of what malchus is, what kingship should be, what it really is. The Torah definition of a king requires him to be a person who has summary arbitrary life and death power. We don't have those today. The halachic question of whether you make a blessing, it's a serious question. You know, you're supposed to make a blessing when you see a non-Jewish king and a slightly different blessing when you see a Jewish king or queen. Today is a very serious halachic question if you can make a blessing if you see the queen or a king. The reason is they do not have summary life and death power. That's synonymous with royalty. But we don't have that anymore. The only place where you have that is in the Arab world. Dead hasn't been lost. And I'm not going to go now into the reasons and what it means spiritually. But in the Arab world you have that. If you see an Arab king, you can certainly make a blessing. Because there's absolute summary life and death power there. Believe me. But not in what we're familiar with. So you have to picture a real king who has that incredible power. Imagine you step in the presence of a king like that in the throne room. And the king says to you, don't spit on the floor. The king says, don't kill any of my servants and don't spit on the floor. And you go, you know what they do? They instantly and gracefully separate your head from your body. That's what they do. Without a moment's hesitation. You only spat on the floor. But you disobeyed the king in his presence. Can you see, what's going on here is the act of disobedience. It's not the intrinsic harm. The intrinsic harm is measured on a different scale. How much damage did you do in the king's kingdom? Killing one of his subjects is a massive degree of harm. Spitting on his floor is almost insignificant. So the punishment for that will go in proportion. But the disobedience has got nothing to do with, can you feel this? Just to make it tangible to our childlike imaginations. And therefore, a world formed with justice, there is no leniency, there are no second chances, there's no making good afterwards, as soon as any created being steps out of line, there's instant disappearance from existence. So how can you say the world is judged with goodness? Din, nidon, means the world is judged. Judgment means exact. To a hair's breadth and more. How can you say that the judgment takes place with a goodness? Can you see the contradiction? Goodness means an extension, a leniency. They're in utter contradiction. And that's the principle. The world is judged with goodness. It means that justice is happening all the time, exactly the way it should. And yet there's extensions and kindness. Can you see the same contradiction? But it will reveal itself. What we discussed last week, the concept of Tchilas HaMaaseh means that it'll be relived. And in that relived version, every moment of the resolution of these two paradoxical opposites will be revealed. Now we live behind the mask and behind the screen, but that's... Now the Rambam says this, amazing thing. The Mishnah says, do we have the picture? The Mishnah starts out without any name. Announces the following. Hakol Tzafui, right? All is foreknown. By Rishus Nesuna, and free will is given. And the clue, the hint that those two are in conflict is Ubatuba Olam Nidoin, and the world is judged with goodness. Right? Which phrases the fact that these two are put together. Says the Rambam. The Rambam comes and comments on this Mishnah, and he says the mysterious words. He says, Ra'oi, he says, this Mishnah is fitting for the one who said it, Rabbi Akiva. The Rambam says, this Mishnah, look it up yourself. The Rambam says, this Mishnah is fitting for the one who said it, Rabbi Akiva. This, how did Rambam know this is Rabbi Akiva? Let's try and understand that. Who was Rabbi Akiva? What does that mean? Why is he the one who must be the author? To the extent that he doesn't even have to say his name, and it's obvious that he's the author. Let's go back to the root. When the world was created, now this is very, again we can say the words, right? All we can do is say the words. When the world was created, the phrasing in the sources, right, is like this. Ala b'machshava, ala b'machshava, it came up in thought, meaning it rose in Hashem's mind. These are all mystical terms. Ala b'machshava, it came up in Hashem's mind, livrois ha'olam b'din, to create the world with din. Justice. Ra'a she'eno ele miskai. He saw that the world could not exist. He saw that a world like that could not exist. Amad v'shitav ima midas harachamim. So he got up and he combined, in his act of creation, he combined with the justice, the attribute of mercy. Rachamim. Right? Actually, the word rachamim, just to understand, in Hebrew all the words are exact. In rachamim, now the word din in Hebrew, to understand Hebrew, the word din in Hebrew, which means justice, is from the word die. Die means enough, exact. Huh? And rachamim is the word rechem, which means the womb. The womb, among many other things, like we've explained here many times, the womb is that organ that is central. It's a combination of the right hand of goodness and kindness and the left hand of justice. That's what rachamim means. It means the combination. The womb, therefore, is the place where the human being is conceived. Why? Because it's the conception. The human being is the result of an admixture of the justice that was the original plan of the world and the kindliness that was added in subsequently. And the combination of these two in the midline, as it were, that is the resulting human being. That's why the word rechem in Hebrew, which means the womb, is the root of the word rachamim, which is the loving kindness that is the mixture of chesed and din. Actually, as I pointed out before, the word rechem, if you rearrange the letters, it spells ramach, which is the 248 parts of the human body that are formed in the womb. Or if you rearrange the letters in their third permutation, it spells machar, which is tomorrow. The reason that there is a future, that's what birth is all about, right? Conception and birth. The reason there is a future is because justice and kindliness are admixed. There would be no tomorrow if the world were created only in strict justice. And he saw that. And there would be no tomorrow. Therefore he admixed, right? And that's what the meaning of this womb, rechem, rachamim is. Now the question, there are many questions here, but one of the questions is, what does it mean he wanted to create the world with din? We're not talking about afterthoughts here, we're talking about the creator. See, when you translate this into human terminology, you have to have the humility to understand these things in their root, and not the way, in human terms it means, he wanted to create the world with din, so I thought about it a second time and thought, no, that's not a good plan. When then it's mixed in rachamim, and then everything worked. It's not what's being said. It's not what's being said. What's being said is that he wanted to create the world with din, means that's the way it had to be, and that's the way it is. But he mixed together with it rachamim. You can't mix rachamim with din. As soon as you put a little bit of goodness, a little bit of rachamim in, there's no din anymore. Is this right? If you come to court, and we're now going to judge the case on its merits exactly. Exactly, every detail yields exactly what it's supposed to yield. And then the judge says, well, we'll be lenient about it. Well, one second, that's not justice. I'm not saying it's bad. It's survival. It's what allows us to survive. But it's not justice. But again, it doesn't say that. It said he wanted to create the world with justice. It does not say that he annulled the justice and instead created... It doesn't say that. It says he combined kindliness with the justice. Meaning they're both there. They're both there. Allah b'machshava came up in his mind. And there are many outcomes of this. One of the outputs of this is the fact that when the trees were created, you remember when the trees were created, the Torah says they sinned. Remember this? That the earth brought forth trees. The earth was supposed to bring forth trees that tasted the same as their fruit, where the trees and the fruit would taste the same. And it says that the earth sinned. The earth doesn't have free will. The earth does not have free will. But it says that the earth brought out trees that do not taste the same as the fruit. They're tasteless, and the fruit is tasty. And then it says, when Adam sinned, the earth was cursed for its sin. Not before. It has no free will. But when Adam sinned, he crashed the whole world into a cursed situation. Now the earth is cursed. Arura adama baborecha. The land, the earth is cursed for you. What's going on? It's deep ideas, but the earth brought out trees that do not taste the same as the fruit, because the earth understood that there needs to be free will. Free will means there's a process that you don't understand, that is not tasty, you cannot taste, it's dry, and it brings forth a fruit that is tasty. Incidentally, as an aside, that's why our mitzvahs, do you know that? That's why our mitzvahs are tasteless. There's a whole section in the Gemara talks about this. You can't taste the mitzvah. You can taste the learning of Torah, that has sweetness. A little bit of sweetness has been left. It says in the final stage, be ecstatic, beyond belief. But right now it's been limited. But there's a sweetness in tasting the words of Torah. But when you put tefillin on your arm, there's no sweetness in the action. There's sweetness in the elevation of service, and there's also, but there's no sweetness in the action. What we call the gufa du'uvda, the act itself. Are you with me? There's no spiritual high from the act. It's dry. Why? Because it's a process. Mitzvah is physical activity in the world. And physical activity in the world is part of the world, which is a tasteless tree. The fruit is sweet. That will be, but not now. And this needs more analysis. So the world understood, the earth understood that it could not bring out trees, that the commandment did not really mean to bring out trees that taste the same as the fruit. Because where would be the free will? If the process were sweet, then who would not do it? It had to bring out a dry process, only later with a faith insight to yield the sweetness. It had to do that. Now you may ask, well, if that's what it was intended to do, why was it commanded otherwise? Because the original depth of the creation was meant to be that way and will be that way. But the process of getting there is with human difficulty and free will. There would have been no curse in that, but when Adam misused it, and that became the cause of his downfall, then the curse manifested there. And there are many other outcomes of this. Ari says, now we're really treading on dangerous territory, but I'm going to risk it. I'm not here next week, you know. You'll know where they're sitting. The Midrash says that before this world, there were worlds created and destroyed. You know that Midrash? Like sparks that fly from the anvil and die. Until this world was created, which found favor in Hashem's eyes, and this is the world that remained. Worlds were created and destroyed. A lot of meanings to this. A lot of meanings. But the great Arizal, the great Kabbalistic master, explains, brings sources that say that it's referring here to 974 generations of souls who were created before the world. The Tatka Ad-Doiris, Taf Taf Kuf Ayin Dalet, there were 974 generations of souls with free will created before the world, and they were all destroyed. They were very evil, extremely evil. They behaved in an extremely negative fashion. And they were all destroyed until finally the world was created in the fashion that it did. And 26 generations later, the Torah was given. Right? The reason, of course, is the Arizal learns this because it says, "Davar tziva le'elef doir." Hashem's word was commanded to the thousandth generation. The Torah was given to the thousandth generation. What thousands? There haven't been a thousand generations. Where? What thousand generations? The whole world has only had. Yeah, how many generations have lived since the beginning of time? Yeah, we're now in the year 5760. In 5,760 years, how many generations can you fit? The Rambam counts 80 generations from the giving of the Torah till now. 80, that's all. Right? 3,200 years ago, approximately. 40 years a generation, that's 3,200 years. So you cover 3,200 years with 80 generations. Where are you going to get 1,000 from? Says the Ari, they're not referring to that. There were 974 generations before the world was created, and 26 generations completing 1,000 to when the Torah was given. 10 from Adam to Noah, 10 from Noah to Avram, 6 from Avram to Moshe. 26, which is Hashem's name, of course. You haven't missed that, right? The Yud Kei Vav Kei adds up to 26. Hashem's name manifested in the world and brought about the giving of the Torah. That's what it means. The 26th generation. Why 26 is another also discussion, but that's what it was. So added to the 974, the Torah was given to the 1,000th generation. Why were they so evil, those souls? Because they were the souls who were created in a world of strict justice. You can't survive there. You can't survive. When the world, they were brought up in that, they were the creations, the souls that were brought into existence in that phase of absolute and pure justice. There's no room to move their hair's breadth. As soon as a human being arrives in consciousness, he dies. Again, needs more explanation, and that's for after midnight. But that's black belt stuff and beyond me. But that's what it says. And then Adam was created in a world where there was an admixture of justice and rachamim, such a place a human being could survive. And that was the continuation of the next 26 and subsequent generations. What happened to those 974? What happened to them? Sources, they were destroyed and they were split up and implanted in all the future generations. Yeah, the souls were reborn in all the generations that live now through the history of the world. They are the brazen-faced, chutzpah-filled individuals that inhabit the generations. In case you didn't notice, we got quite a dose of them in ours. But each generation has... Anyway, that is the... What are we learning? What are we saying? What are we saying? We're saying that there was a system of din, strict justice, no leniency, no leeway. The world cannot survive that way. And therefore there was a mixture of the kindliness, the justice, the kindliness with the justice, and that is how the world survives. Shittuf, a shittuf. There's a partnership between strict justice, rachamim. They contradict each other, but they both apply. They're woven together, even though you can't see that. And they're going where they have to go. Who was Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva was the father and the central figure of the oral law. Kulu, it says, Alibad Rabbi Akiva. All the statements of the Talmud, all the opinions in the oral law, trace themselves originally to Rabbi Akiva. Who was he? Rabbi Akiva was a stupendous individual. He was the product of converts to Judaism. Like many greats, he was beyond belief in terms of he began as a man who had no learning at all, as the ultimate inspiration for the Baal Teshuva world. 40 years old, he knew nothing. He had such a hatred of people who learned that he could bite off the arm of a learned man, like a wild ass, it says. And he married a woman who saw his potential. Amazing story. Now's not the time to go into the story. She saw his tremendous transcendent potential. She married him on condition that he would go and learn. And Rabbi Akiva accepted the challenge, it says, only because he saw the water dripping on the rock. You must know these things. And he saw the water dripping on the rock, and it had etched a depression in the rock. And he said, a thing as soft as water could make an impression in a thing as hard as rock, and Torah can penetrate me. And he went to learn, and it was an incredible dedication. So he was 40 years old, he went away to learn. His wife sent him, he went away for 12 years. She sent him for 12 years, they're poverty stricken. She was one of the wealthiest. She came from one of the wealthiest families in Yerushalayim at the time, a stupendous, almost indescribable wealth. And her family rejected her because she married this unlearned shepherd. In fact, her father made an oath that he'd never accept Rabbi Akiva ever. They lived in poverty, they slept in straw, they slept on straw. She sent him away to learn Torah. And he went away for 12 years to learn Torah. And at the end of 12 years, without ever having seen his wife in the interim, he walked into the house after 12 years, he'd come home. And he heard her. He heard the neighbors mocking her. He heard the neighbors telling her, what are you waiting for? You'll never come back. What hope was there, etc. And he heard his wife reply that if he'd walk in now, I would send him back for another 12 years. That's what he heard. Rabbi Akiva turned around. He turned around, he went back and learned for another 12 years without seeing her or greeting her. 24 years later, he came back. All the sources say, why did he have to go back without seeing her? He could have spent a day at home. He could have... The answer is, it's a misunderstanding of Torah learning. Torah learning is a process that's an exponential growth, that each day feeds on the day before. There's an exponential growth in Torah learning. If you fall asleep at night over your learning and you wake up charged by the same learning, the next day is a different day. Rabbi Akiva knew that 12 years and 12 years is not the same as 24 years. And he came back 24 years later, but he was the greatest man alive. Came back with an entourage of sages and his father-in-law was forced to annul his oath, and he lived to be 120 years old. He was the father of the oral law. He brought down, he revealed the oral law. He was the equivalent in the oral law of Moshe Rabbeinu Moses in the written. And what happened to Rabbi Akiva was he was killed by the Romans. An 120-year-old sage, they tore him apart, literally. They brutalized him, they tortured him, they literally, and his flesh was sold in the marketplace of Rome. So the Gemara says that when he was being tortured thus, literally, and his students were standing around, the Romans executing him, his Talmidim were standing around, and he, unbelievable story, the Gemara says that he said Shema as he died. He said Shema, Shema Yisrael, declaring Hashem's oneness. And the Talmidim said, Ad Kan, yeah, that far, you have to go, how do you? And he said to them, all my life, I've longed for the moment. All my life, I had pain that I couldn't sanctify Hashem's name. You have to understand again what this means. It doesn't mean he would long to die as a martyr. But he meant that what he meant was his whole life was dedicated to being nothing other than the service of Hashem. That's what he meant. I longed all my life to be nothing other than a vehicle for his revelation. And now I shouldn't say Shema. But while that was happening, the Gemara says the angels complained. They said to Hashem, Zu Torah v'zu Schara. This is Torah and this is its reward. This is justice. Here's the greatest man. And look what he brought to the world. And look at what cost. Look what he's contributed. Look who he is. This is Torah and this is its reward. And the Gemara says Hashem answered as follows, Shtoik. That means silence. Kach ala b'machshava lefanai. Thus it has arisen in my mind. That if you ask one more question, I'll return the world to its state of void. The world will return to its unformed state. You ask one more question about this justice that you cannot understand. You angels cannot understand. You ask one more question about this. You push the matter one step further, I'll return the world to its state of void. Now what's going on? Can you hear the words kach ala b'machshava? We've heard those words before. Kach ala b'machshava, thus it has arisen in my mind. The same words that Hashem used, the same words that the Torah uses about the process of the original creation in Din. You know what Din means? Din means absolute justice. The downside of Din means that a hair's breadth, you disappear. The upside of Din means if you can live at that level, you deserve your own existence. You earn it and you deserve it. Rabbi Akiva was able to live at a level where the hair's breadth yields results that are indescribable. But he merited his own existence. A human being who lived by his own merit. Not claiming any. He didn't need any handouts. See, in a world of rachamim means you get extensions, you get credit, you get handouts. Mixed in with the justice. That's not the way it was designed originally. And what will ultimately reveal it is that a human being lives where you deserve and merit and acquire your own existence. And Akiva was able to get to a level. And therefore, when they asked questions, this is how it works. Hashem, the same words were used as the original methodology, the original mode of creation, which is that it's exactly the way it has to be, in which you either earn and deserve your existence or you don't exist. And he looked on that level and revealed it. And therefore the Rambam can say, who could be the author of our Mishnah if not Rabbi Akiva? The Mishnah doesn't have to say who it is, because who else could it be if not he, who's able to manifest that original purpose of creation, which in fact is what the oral law comes to reveal. To delve beneath the surface of creation, to reveal the way it's supposed to be. That is what. There's more to say here, but it's a heavy subject. I'll add one more word just for those who are interested. Yes? Once we're in this deep. One more word. One more word, just a couple of minutes. You know that, just to show you how far this goes, again, we're just introducing the subject, but this paradox, this conflict runs throughout all of life and all of Torah. Just give you one more example for those who have a little Torah background, and especially for those who will investigate these things further. You'll be perplexed to know that in the names of Hashem, in the divine names, the whole world is a revelation of divine names. The Ramban says that the whole Torah is names of Hashem. Everything revealed in the Torah is nothing other than a divine name. You know, we have the name of Hashem, Yud-Kei, Vav-Kei, right? That we never pronounce, right? We never pronounce it. We always say Adoy, right? We say that word in place of the word that we cannot pronounce. Every name of Hashem indicates a quality. Do you know that? Every name indicates a midah, a quality, a facet of revelation. The word Elohim, for example, means strict justice. Elohim. In fact, its secular meaning is judges. The word Adoi, Adnus as it's called, Adnut, that word, that means Hashem's mastery of the world. Each name means a quality of Hanhoga, the way He runs the world. What does the name Yudkei Vavkei mean? That what we call the name of essence, Shema Etzem, the name of essence of Hashem. That reveals His essence, His existence. That is what the name conveys. Everything, all of existence. The name itself means was, is, and will be. In other words, essence transcending time, as we began this discussion. The problem is that there's some sources that say that that name is the name of Rachamim, of kindliness. That's a contradiction. Kindliness, Rachamim, we said, right, is a particular quality. So how can the name, that is the name of the essence and totality of Hashem, also be the name of one particulate midah? Can you see the problem? And people misunderstand. The truth is, the name of Hashem, Yudkei Vavkei, the name of essence, is not the name of a particulate quality. The name, that name means Rachamim, means kindliness, that exists together with Din, and is no conflict and no contradiction. That is everything that Hashem is, in His revelation to the world. So when we say Yudkei Vavkei, we don't mean His kindliness as opposed to His strict attribute of justice. We mean the name that puts them together, manifests that within that, in an ultimate contradiction that we cannot understand, and yet they both richly apply. Anyway, the message is that we, if we're here to learn fundamentals of Judaism, one fundamental is He is beyond time, He is all that there is. The other fundamental is you're entirely free, as if He has nothing to do with you. As if He has nothing to do with you. And you have full responsibility for that. As if. Are the two reconcilable? No. Axiomatic in Jewish belief, they are both fully applied. How can they possibly be resolved? While in the world of darkness and, so to speak, illusion, you can't see them. If you could, you wouldn't be free. But it will be revealed. It will be revealed. There are sources that say that the name Yudkei Vavkei, there's another version, there's a Hebrew word, Yihyeh. Yihyeh in Hebrew means it will be. Yihyeh, it shall be. That's not a holy name, it's not a holy word, but it will be. It will be. As opposed to Yudkei Vavkei, in which there's a Yud and a He, but it's not reflected by its revelation in the world. In there it looks like a Vav and a He. One day that word will reveal the essence, revealing its manifestation of